The U.S. territory of Puerto Rico is recovering from multiple disasters, battling back from the COVID pandemic, all while people on the island are struggling with poverty and food insecurities. I'm Robin Shannon, and this is Fordham Conversations, We the People, when we delve into the intricate issues surrounding racial and ethnic minorities, including the injustices, challenges, and progresses being made in these communities. Today, I'm talking with Dr. Gregory Acevedo, Associate Professor in Fordham University's Graduate School of Social Service. We'll look at what led up to the challenges in Puerto Rico and why Dr. Acevedo says Puerto Rico's crisis is America's crisis. I got that from your article. Hope that's okay.
Very good. Yeah.
So welcome, Dr. Acevedo.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Can I call you Greg?
Yes, Greg is fine. Thanks.
Greg, I want to jump into it. How did poverty in Puerto Rico become such a chronic issue?
Okay, you know, it's really centuries in the making, in the sense that we have a typical population of the Caribbean, Latin America, very rural, peasant. So, you know, we had a situation of poverty in Puerto Rico under Spanish colonialism that just kind of, you know, switches then into the era of U.S., you know, dominance of the island. Or, I mean, that could be framed different ways, so I know it's controversial, but...
That's okay, the 1800s?
But, yeah, so when it becomes a U.S. territory, basically, in the early 1900s. So Spanish, you know, Spanish-American War, 1898... Teddy Roosevelt, San Juan Hill, all that lovely stuff, right? But anyway, eventually Puerto Rico comes under the influence of U.S. governance. But it remains in this kind of state of suspended animation where it's not fully, it's a territory of the U.S., but it's not fully, let's say, vested with all the rights and responsibilities of U.S. citizenship. So you're born a U.S. citizen. But
you can't vote for president.
Exactly. No representative in Congress, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, these, you know, these facts have been often cited. Some people make a direct connection between that kind of level of disenfranchisement and poverty. And of course, in U.S. social science, that's something that goes back clearly to the era of the war on poverty in the 1960s. You know, that was a big thrust of the civil rights movement and the civil rights and voting acts was, you know, poverty and disenfranchisement. It isn't a coincidence that the two often go hand in hand, right? So that's a legacy then that goes back, you know, at least till, let's say, the early 1900s. There were attempts to try to kind of jumpstart Puerto Rico into modern kind of like industrial economy. Operation Bootstrap, it was called. Part of that is the reason why Puerto Ricans are in New York City in such large numbers. I mean, it's down now. In fact, Florida surpassed New York State as the largest population of Puerto Ricans now in the latest census. So,
Greg, can you back up a little? What is Operation Bootstrap?
Operation Bootstrap was an attempt by the U.S. government. It was basically an economic development plan. And the goal was to industrialize Puerto Rico very quickly. Part of the goal was to kind of move away from this almost plantation sugar cane economy into an industrial economy. Part of that plan was also to encourage out-migration, because part of the theory was, you know, you had an overpopulation, if you will. Too many people, not enough resources, et cetera, et cetera. And so there was an active recruiting of Puerto Ricans to work in places like New York City. There were employment bureaus that basically were recruiting directly, from the island. And that's really kind of how the first, Puerto Rican migration is interesting to the U.S. in that there was a decent stream in the 1800s, even before it was a U.S. territory. And that was really... a very interesting kind of political population that was fighting at the time for independence from Spain. One of our most, let's say, famous independence leaders, Pedro Albizu Campos, for example, he was at Harvard at the time, and that would have been, I guess, in the early 1900s. I think he fought in World War I. And he, at Harvard, began to basically fall in with people who were part of the Irish Republican struggle, saw many similarities in the struggle of Ireland in terms of, independence as a colonial kind of a vestige of the, of England. So, there were populations in Tampa that were very quite well known. That was partly because of the cigar industry, cigar rolling. And then in New York, there's always been a population, a lot of intellectuals, poets, things like that. But it was really the explosion of the 40s and 50s that kind of left that imprint of Puerto Ricans in New York. And that's where poverty comes in terms of, you know, my area, the social sciences. A very well-known book, La Vida, by Oscar Lewis. And La Vida was a, you know, basically an ethnography of a Puerto Rican family living in poverty. And so from that point on, Puerto Ricans were associated with this culture of poverty thesis in the social sciences, right? And unfortunately, there's two groups that have been really associated with that culture of poverty thesis the most in U.S. social science. It's been Blacks and it's been Puerto Ricans. No surprise that in many ways, obviously, one of the reasons is that, you know, Puerto Ricans are a major Afro-Latino population. So the idea of race can't be kind of like, you know, untangled from this when it comes to why Puerto Rico might be different and Puerto Ricans might be different than other Spanish-speaking countries in Latin America and elsewhere. And so the culture of poverty thesis was, well, you probably remember the whole Daniel Patrick Moynihan. That whole kind of, you know, philosophy that the reason for poverty was cultural. It was individual behaviors. It was cultural traits. It was motivation. So some of the
Not the system?
Correct. Structural issues, you know, it depends. I mean, Oscar Lewis was actually kind of a liberal. So, you know, there's this interesting debate where you have people like Edward Bainfield was a conservative social scientist. He took much more of the kind of, you know, emphasis on the cause of this intergenerational poverty is really the culture of this particular population, right? Whereas Oscar Lewis would have probably framed it as, yes, there are kind of, let's say, cultural traits and behaviors and differences in maybe motivation, et cetera, but it's due to the circumstances that poverty, you know, of living in poverty. So it's a response to the context of poverty. So at least he was throwing structural issues on the table. But sadly, that kind of, you know, that was kind of dismissed as being the major part of the dynamic. And so much like African-Americans, the accusation was, you know, lack of motivation to work, lack of entrepreneurial zeal, a propensity to, you know, not follow the typical form of a middle-class family formation. So, you know, broken marriages, children out of wedlock, teenage pregnancy. I mean, the list is fairly similar, I would argue, in terms of how the culture of poverty thesis.
Greg, has the White House done anything to step in and help?
I would argue it's piecemeal. Under Trump, it was nothing. It was throwing paper towels. My mother is incensed by that scene still today. She just, you know, she can't look at a paper towel roll and not, you know, basically just lose it in terms of what that symbol was all about to her. Thank you. Yeah, thank you for the paper towels. But, you know, obviously, Democratic administrations have been, let's say, more at least giving in terms of thinking about how to support Puerto Rico. But there's major problems. I think there's currently a couple lawsuits that could make their way to Supreme Court about public assistance benefits on the island. So they're U.S. citizens, but the level of benefits that they get are much lower than the stateside population. And so if you're on Medicaid on the island or receiving disability funds, et cetera, the payout rates are so much lower. And so, you know, there's a couple cases currently, I don't know the names of them, but working their way through, but basically trying to sue in the courts for higher benefit rates for things like public assistance programming, which obviously are a dire need now more than ever, one could argue. So, you know, the financial crisis, that's a different story. There are different points of views about that. How did it get there? Well, you know, clearly there were the issues of debt that had been built up by the Puerto Rican government. And then Wall Street, you know, basically was, you know, saying, well, you know, you're basically a junk bond status. You can't cover your debts, right? So then that began this kind of like downward spiral and the inability to be able to show that it was going to pay its debts led to basically this financial oversight. You know, the acronym is PROMESA, which promise, right? So it's got kind of two meanings to it. One could argue maybe that's the promise that, you know, the U.S. is delivering on its promise to take care of its own or the promise of the future. But there's been a lot of arguments that, you know, I mean, the group, for example, meets in New York City. It doesn't meet in Puerto Rico, where would you meet? You would meet where basically
where the trouble is.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's Wall Street, I would argue. Again, you know, I know there's other points of view on that, but I guess I'm pretty clear on what my opinion is. And it's not like, unlike many other kinds of scenarios we saw leading up to the financial crisis of 2008, where, you know, Wall Street was fully cognizant of the fact that there were a lot of risks here and we're taking those risks, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's just interesting that you could say a bank is too big to fail, but an island of 3.2 million or so now isn't too big to fail, right? And then, of course, who's appointed to the oversight board, et cetera. So, you know, it's received critiques from a lot of people on political grounds in terms of representation. So here again, another example of disenfranchisement of Puerto Rico. And, you know, by some economists, too, who are arguing this isn't the way to resolve it, because the emphasis is really, again, on paying the debts to, you know, to the financial interests that are owed money, quote unquote, when the Puerto Rican people didn't necessarily always have a direct, you know, what the government was doing under its economic plans and other things. It's not like there's a direct voting referendum every time the government moves ahead on its decisions about these things. But so I think, you know, there's that issue. There's the issue that people often point out. By the way, that whole thing with the courts, there's this insular cases. They're the history of the insular cases that go back to 1901, I think. There's some famous quotes on the floor of Congress about, you know, senators talking about Puerto Rico and the other territories that would be taken in as U.S. territories, Guam and others, and basically being very clear that these people are savages and they cannot be trusted to handle their business on their own, right? We will bring them civilization. You know, it's our responsibility as a more enlightened nation to, you know, I mean, it was that whole, you know, philosophy that I wouldn't say it's gone away completely. It certainly exists in certain circles. It may not be, you probably couldn't be as obvious about, you know, on the floor of Congress. Well, I don't know. These days, maybe you could. sorry, but I can't help but editorialize sometimes. But
that's okay. That's why you're here. That's why you're here.
But yeah, you know, so these insular cases were always around this issue of, again, self-determination and you know, full status as U.S. citizens, how much are we disenfranchised, et cetera. And then there's the issues around trade and the fact that, you know, Puerto Rico as an island can't be a free agent as an entity and make economic agreements with, like, even states in the United States can go into economic agreements, right, on their own. But with Puerto Rico, it's this issue that everything has to be authorized by the U.S., and I believe even the ships that have to carry the goods have to be, you know, certain ships, U.S. ports. These kinds of policies have just, you know, the disenfranchisement, I can't emphasize enough how you can be that disenfranchised, literally, in terms of voting rights, this idea of economic determination, things that, you know, we, on, you know, stateside, we wouldn't accept. There's no way we would, right? But somehow it's okay with Puerto Rico. So, you know, I mean, how do you combat poverty? There's big debates about that one, right? In social science, it's still on the table as to what that, you know, what the best policies are to do, you know, to combat poverty.
This is Fordham Conversations on 90.7 WFUV. I'm Robin Shannon discussing Puerto Rico's poverty challenge with Dr. Gregory Acevedo, associate professor in the Graduate School of Social Service. He says Puerto Rico's crisis is America's crisis. Do the Puerto Rican people in Puerto Rico have ideas about what they want as opposed to what's being, you know, forced upon them?
Well, it's not univocal. You know, I mean, I think you have a political spectrum in Puerto Rico too, right? There's the, you know, there's the plebiscites that have taken place in the past, although more recently there's some controversy about how the actual wording of the plebiscite was done and the voting was done. So there's a
What's a plebiscite?
So a public vote, literally. It's non-binding, but, you know, there have been several in Puerto Rico. And the basic question has been statehood, remain a commonwealth, or independence. Generally, it's been pretty close between statehood and commonwealth. Mm-hmm. Independence has been certainly a small minority, but there's a long history there too in terms of heavy-handed kind of treatment on the part of the United States of the Puerto Rican independence movement.
What are the differences, Greg, or the similarities between the commonwealth or statehood?
So statehood would be statehood.
Well, right. Okay, I got that part.
many people like myself would say, what is the probability of Congress and then a U.S. presidential administration accepting Puerto Rico as a state that's going to be much poorer than Mississippi, that has a Spanish-speaking population, that clearly has a kind of cultural context that's very different than any state in the United States would be. So
where's the fear then? Yeah. What's the fear from?
What do you mean in terms of the U.S.?
Making Puerto Rico a state.
I think some of that would be aligned with that old conservative take on the culture of poverty. Why would you want to incorporate this territory as a state when basically you've got a long history of, intergenerational poverty, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
So is the idea that background will somehow negatively affect the members of Congress or certain members of Congress?
Well, it certainly wouldn't look good in certain political circles, right? It's funny because there's been some kind of, at least on the face of it, political support of the Republican Party for statehood. But I don't know if their heart's really in it, because this is the same party that often talks about now it's gotten to the absurdity of racial replacement, right? But this idea of, we've got too many Mexican immigrants or Latin American immigrants in this country. It's bringing our country down. The constant accusation that, it's going to be just a bloating of the welfare rolls. And, they often cite things like the crime rate in Puerto Rico. And, that's just going to be importing crime. And, fact is, we have freedom of movement anyway, right? So there's nothing stopping that one way or the other. But if I had to prognosticate, I'm not thinking statehood anytime soon.
And what about Commonwealth? What would the...
Well, leaving it alone, it's just inertia, right? So that's probably where it'll stay. But now you've got this wrinkle of a financial oversight committee that's... It almost goes back to the days before we had our own elected governor, and it used to be basically a kind of resident commissioner, right, appointed by the U.S., and it took so long to get, that impetus and movement to get the first Puerto Rican governor appointed, but now you have this kind of... you can't say foreign entity because, again, it's the U.S.
territory.
Right? Puerto Rico's strange, right? It's interesting, let's just say, in its circumstances, because it is unlike many other Latin American and Spanish-speaking populations in the United States, where there's at least this clear boundary of even things like borders, right, and citizenship, et cetera, et cetera. The irony that many people point out is that before the U.S. Basically ousted Spain, people in the island had worked out for the first time an arrangement with Spain, and we were going to have representation actually in the Spanish Parliament. And it was kind of this big watershed moment that was about to happen in terms of all this, independence struggle against Spain finally leading to a payoff in terms of shared governance. And then, boom, within, this transition, it was almost a great leap backwards in terms of disenfranchisement again. So,
can you explain the idea that there's been a reduction in Puerto Rican professionals who are economically considered the middle class moving from Puerto Rico to other areas? And how will that affect Puerto Rico?
Yeah, I mean, all those issues, again, are kind of overlapping. So that I think it was almost a 12% drop in the population of the island between the 2010 and the 2020 census. So, rarely in the history of global migration do you get an out-migration that leads to literally having more people living away from the home country, if you will, than there. So I think there's 5-point-something million Puerto Ricans living stateside, and there's about 3.2 on the island. And like I said, lost about, I think it's 12% of the population between 2010 and 2020. A lot of that was what's called brain drain, you know, some of the similar patterns that you see in other Caribbean and developing nations where people with, you know, higher level degrees, professionals are finding their livelihoods, you know, the pay scales are much higher in the United States. Some would say it's also the kind of social conditions in terms of crime and, you know, things like that as well. But yeah, clearly, I can say anecdotally, I have friends who were born and raised on the island. They were often schooled here, so they've gone to very good universities in the, you know, in the stateside. But their intent was always to go back to the island, right? But I've seen that calculus over the years change, and, you know, so many of them, if not all of them, are here. You know, they're living stateside.
Are your friends deciding to stay stateside because of any particular, well, is there any particular reason? Is it the hurricane or earthquake or the poverty?
I think it's mostly just the, you know, let's say you end up with a medical degree or law degree. You've probably got some debt. And, you know, the salary ranges on the island versus the salary ranges stateside, you know, they're two different worlds, really. And so the economic incentive to be stateside, you know, I have friends who are professors, for example, and, you know, yeah, their dream was to be, you know, at UPR. Who wouldn't want to be at the University of Puerto Rico? But then there's the concrete reality of just, you know, well, first of all, you've got a university that's been defunded, you know, steadily, less jobs available, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, I would say probably say the same thing about doctors, lawyers, et cetera. It's just, you know, your career trajectory is going to be very different if you stay on the island or if you move stateside. So
with this brain drain, what is happening in Puerto Rico because of that?
Well, I mean, I think it limits, like, for example, in the healthcare system, you've got less, you know, the labor pool is different, right? It's a much smaller labor pool. So then again, you could argue demand's lower now because so many people have left, right? So, but generally speaking, it's never a good thing for a country, right? When its professional population is moving out, you know, there's also the kind of element of the role models, the mentors, the, you know, you leave a very, I mean, class diversity is an important thing, right? Most people would agree that it's good to have that kind of, you know, many people talk about the Cuban population in Miami, and it's like you've got this class diversity from people, you know, who are highest level entrepreneurs who found companies like Blockbuster. And then you've got perhaps the more recent Cuban immigrant who just came and is maybe still driving a cab. But you've got this, you know, diversity of talent, education, knowledge, skills, et cetera, et cetera.
And that's what's moving out.
The top end, if you will, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Would you say, Greg, that there are U.S. immigration policies that are being used to marginalize Puerto Ricans?
Well, again, it's not really about immigration as much as it's really, I think, you know, it sounds too simplistic perhaps, but it still always comes down to the status question. Right. The fact that if it remains in this quasi state status without its full rights and responsibilities, unable to access, you know, welfare state benefits in the way that other, you know, the stateside population does, I think a lot of it has to do more with that. And, you know, I wrote a piece in the HuffPo years ago, and it was about, like, let's get this dance over with. You know, it was based on West Side Story, and it's like, all right, we've been dancing.
Can you tell me about it?
Well, you know, basically my point was that, you know, you go back to that famous West Side Story, which I'm kind of excited because there's now this new interpretation that's coming out. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, it's kind of like goes back to Sharks and Jets and this kind of cultural friction that goes back of, are you us or are you them? You know, it's them versus us. Are we the same? Are we not the same? Let's finish the dance. You know, the choreography should be, you know, okay, it's done now. But I think there's been, what, four plebiscites? I can't swear to it, but there's been at least four plebiscites in the past. And then, so this new legislation would put another one on the table. But again, the issue of not being non-binding, so that, do you respect the population of Puerto Rico enough to say, whatever you vote, that's what we're going to deliver on? Because that's not the case. It's all been non-binding. So it's kind of like, we'll listen to your opinion, but we're not going to act on it unless we choose to act on it.
There's a lot going on in Puerto Rico in relations to poverty, but it's not all bad. Help me understand, and if I'm pronouncing this wrong, you know, forgive me and correct me. What is La Brega?
La Brega. I mean, I remember my mom and dad, that's a phrase that would come up repeatedly, right? It's partly, I mean, if I self-disclose a little bit, it'll give you some context.
Please,
right?
Do.
So my dad was a migrant farmer. He shows up in first New Jersey, then ends up in New York State, maybe sixth grade education, et cetera, et cetera. But there was always this, you know, life is hard. You might be in a migrant camp. It might not be, it's really cold up here. There's no heat. What is this kind of food? This is, you know, et cetera. But you struggle through it because it's la brega. It's the struggle. And you get, but, you know, there's always hope in that struggle and that it's always leading to something better. Obviously, if not in your lifetime, then for your children, right? And that was always something that I saw both my parents just do the struggle. You know, my dad ended up, he was lucky. There were still factories in Buffalo that were open. You could still get a factory job with a good union and have decent pay and benefits and be able to kind of, you know, move your children into more of a middle class lifestyle, if you will. And then my mother dropped out of high school at 16, but then it was during the war on poverty and she ended up going for a GED program. So we used to sit in the back of the classroom really quiet and she would be taking her classes. And then she ended up getting her a bachelor's in education, a master's in education. She was a public school teacher for 20, you know, La Brega was her having a full-time job, taking care of two kids and then going to school, right? And my dad accommodating that and them shifting responsibilities. If my mom was going to be at school, then he would watch us and who would cook dinner. And so, you know, I mean, it is in that sense, it is the American success story of mobility, social and economic, that many communities know about. Right. It just sounds different with La Brega. Right. You know, there's something spicy about that term. But yeah, no. So it does mean that there's something better on the other side of the struggle. That if you keep working and you keep at it, good things will come. My mom, you know, I call my mom every day, literally. Well, you know, she's getting on now, and my dad passed away a few years ago, and so you know, I used to call every Sunday. From the time I left college at 18, I would call every Sunday, except for those two Sundays I forgot that she still reminded me of over all those years.
Which is now why you call her every day.
But then, yeah, once my dad passed away, then I really, you know, I figured my brother's been very good and he's taking care of her up in Buffalo, but I at least, you know, do my bit by calling every day.
Yeah.
And, she's always, you know, telling, first of all, she tells stories about her mom. And I think that's part of the brega and a lot of the stories about her mom's struggle and what her mom's struggles meant for her and how that led by example. And, you know, and then she'll always end up, you know, keep your head high. Don't lower your head for anybody.
Yeah.
And there really is that sense that I've seen amongst Puerto Ricans, that sense of pride, that poor doesn't mean you don't have pride. Poor doesn't, you know, there's the issue of pine sol, right? Where if you go to an apartment in an apartment building in the Bronx, you're going to probably, sorry, this is so, but you know, you get, because being poor doesn't mean that you're unkempt. Right?
Right.
Things are, and I know these stories will resonate with communities that aren't Puerto Rican.
You're going to smell the pine sol because you're going to clean no matter how small the, you know, your apartment is or how many people are living there, you're going
to
clean it.
Nobody's going to be able to say this about us.
Right.
And yeah, so that pride I think is there. So the brega is really that kind of, you just got to keep at it, keep going.
I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Gregory Acevedo, Associate Professor in Fordham University's Graduate School of Social Service. I'd also like to thank my producer, Anthony Alimo. Once a month, Fordham Conversations We the People delves into the intricate issues surrounding racial and ethnic minorities, including the injustices, challenges, and progresses being made in these communities. For Fordham Conversations We the People, I'm Robin Shannon.